Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Today, the paintings of the French Impressionist painters, those like Degas, Monet, Renoir, Sisley, Cezanne, these are among the most popular works of art ever created. But it was not always that way. The initial public reaction to these painters and their work was hostile. Often the artists themselves were mocked. The paintings were attacked, sometimes physically attacked, when the artists could get them shown at all. This morning, in this first part of Focus 580, we'll look back to one of the most revolutionary periods in the history of art, a time when people changed their minds fairly significantly about what they liked, what they thought was good, and what they thought was important. And our guest is Ross King. He's the author of a new book, which is just recently out. It's titled The Judgment of Paris, the Revolutionary Decade That Gave the World Impressionism. And the book is published by Walker & Company. He's now spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book, and in fact is in Chicago, where he'll be giving a talk at noon today at the Chicago Art Institute, a place that is well known for having a lot of Impressionist paintings there hanging on the walls where you can see them. This book, The Judgment of Paris, makes a contrast between the lives and the work of two artists. One of them, Ernest Meissonier, who was, at the peak of his popularity, the most successful painter of his time, not in only in France, but anywhere. The other was Edouard Manet, who today is among those who is admired and loved for his work, perhaps not an Impressionist, but someone who helped lay the groundwork for Impressionism, and one who, in his own time, certainly was reviled. And the question that Ross King explores in the book is, how is it that now Meissonier, who at one time was the wealthiest, most celebrated painter in the world, why is it now today no one knows who he is, but everyone knows who the Impressionists are? Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. King, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
The thing that I think interests me, one of the many things that interests me, is that if you contrast that time with this, it's true that in our time, sometimes artwork have been very controversial and caused people to protest and to turn out for demonstrations and to talk about the end of the world. But it's really hard to put yourself, I think, in the frame of mind of the time that you're talking about, where there was so much public debate and discussion about art and what was good and what was bad. And to understand, this would have been a time that a piece of music or a piece of art could literally cause a riot.
That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the maybe endearing things about the people of the 19th century that I discovered as I was doing research for the book was just how deeply and passionately they cared about art and the sort of national patrimony, the reputations of their artists in France and so forth. And one aspect of the story that I was very keen to get across was the popularity of the annual salon, this juried art exhibition that literally hundreds of thousands of people would pour into every May. It was said it was the event of the season. It was the most eagerly anticipated public event in France, in Paris, in the 19th century. And the viewing numbers, the people going through the turnstiles, I think would make all art curators in the world today salivate because they got in some years as many as 1 million people over the course of a 6 or 8 week run crowding into this enormous palace of industry to look at art and to discuss it and to debate it and to read about it in the newspapers and also to mock it and jeer it and or in the case of a Meissonier painting to celebrate it and crowd before it. But as you say, they cared deeply about it at this time.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing to probably about the salon to appreciate is just for an artist, just what it would mean to have the work included.
Absolutely. It was essential for you as a painter to get your work shown at the salon. There would be no public for you otherwise. The salon was where all reputations were made. You would expose your work there, hopefully as a young painter, and win medals there. And once your name got into circulation that way, you would begin to sell your paintings both to the French government and to private art collectors. But if the door to the salon was barred to you, you really had absolutely no hope of making your career in art. It really was the proving ground for all artists, not only painters, but also sculptors, engravers, and even, in fact, architects throughout the course of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And many works were submitted, but few were chosen.
Absolutely. In some years, I begin the book in 1863, and in that year, 70% of all works sent to the salon were rejected by the jury. And so if you wanted to get your work shown at the salon, you had to clear this rather formidable hurdle of usually 12 jurors, sometimes as many as 18 or 24, but you had to impress them in some way. They would either give your work the thumbs up or the thumbs down. If they gave it the thumbs down, you would get a rejection slip, and you would have to go to the exhibition hall and retrieve it. It would be stamped on the back with a red R, and you would have to take it back to your studio, and in all likelihood, you would paint it over, because having been rejected from the salon, it sort of had the kiss of death, and you would have to reline it as well to get rid of this emblem of shame, the red R for refusé, rejected, that was stamped on it.
Yeah, the proverbial scarlet letter stamped on the back of
yes.
your painting. And it's also, I think, today one might think, well, knowing the rebellious spirit that artists are famous for, that the artists would take this, the fact that they were refused, as a badge of honor and would say, well, you know, the guardians of the public taste, they may not like my work, but it's actually great. I know it. Maybe a few other people know it. But I don't think that the artists took it that way.
There was a sort of brotherhood that developed in 1863 when so many of the artists were rejected. Many of the young rejected artists were in opposition to the philosophy of the jurors who were members of the Académie des Beaux-Arts, this sort of one of the five branches of the Institut de France, which was charged with governing all French culture, guiding it, directing it, and so forth. These young painters didn't have any particular respect for it at all. And so to be rejected by these men, many of whom were quite elderly and who had made their reputations as much as a half century earlier, to be rejected by them in some ways what didn't mean that in their eyes that they were particularly bad painters. They were trying to forge something new. And it was said that in 1863, when so many works were rejected, a number of painters regarded the term refusé as a badge of honor. Mm. Not everyone viewed it that way, and it was, as we were saying, catastrophic to have your work declined because there were just no other outlets for you to show your work and get your name known.
Yeah. Just very quickly here, let me introduce again our guest, Ross King. He is author of the new book, The Judgment of Paris, the revolutionary decade that gave the world Impressionism. It's just out, and he's spending some time traveling around talking about the book. He's the author, by the way, of a couple of other bestsellers, Brunelleschi's Dome and Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, as well as a couple of novels. He makes his home in England and is now in Chicago. Today he's in Chicago, and we'll be giving a talk at the Art Institute. You can find the book, I'm sure, in the bookstore, and questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about Ernest Meissonier, this man who, as you write in the book, was at the time, at the peak of his popularity, was not only the most celebrated painter in France and elsewhere, he was the wealthiest, the man who perhaps a lot of people would have regarded as the greatest painter living, at least in one time. People would have thought that.
Absolutely. He died. He was born in 1815, died in 1891, and all of his obituaries said that he was the greatest painter of the 19th century. And there were people, friends of his, like Eugène Delacroix, the great romantic painter, said that Delacroix will be forgotten, Ingres will be forgotten, Géricault will be forgotten, Meissonier is the one that everyone will remember. art critics loved him. The most important critic of the day, a man named Théophile Gautier, said that the one artist in France in the 19th century who could count on posterity and count on being consecrated in what he called the museums of the future was Meissonier. And as you say, all of this fame and the critical appreciation, public appreciation, brought him tremendous wealth. And one of the works that I discuss in the book, Napoleonic battle scene called The Campaign of France, was the most expensive painting of the 19th century. More money was paid for it than by any other painting by an artist either living or dead. Not even a Raphael fresco, when it came onto the market in the 1870s, could match what the prices that were paid for Meissonier's work. Really in the last three or four decades of the 19th century. And so as I describe in the book, he enjoyed his money. He lavished it on himself and his family and lived in a kind of faux medieval splendor 12 miles west of Paris at a place called Poissy, where he lived in a converted nunnery and had his yachts on the Seine and a collection of coaches, mail coaches, things like that, sort of rich man's playthings, rich man's toys with which he entertained himself and his guests.
Mm. The other man here that you use as the exemplar of the other style and the other movement, Edouard Manet, one can hardly imagine in many ways someone who would be more different than Meissonier. Meissonier was famously arrogant, sounds like he would have been a rather unpleasant person to be around, was indeed celebrated, was very wealthy, had this enormous house, had all the trappings of success. Manet was apparently very different. He was handsome. He was charming. He embraced this bohemian lifestyle and certainly this very different way of painting. And also, of course, he was someone who was criticized for what he painted and for the way that he painted. So almost the complete opposite.
Absolutely. They were described as the two opposite poles of art. On the one hand, you had Meissonier, and then at the other end of the spectrum, you had Manet. It's very interesting that they shared their initials, EM, but that was really all they shared. Manet was a bit younger than Meissonier. He was born in 1832, which made him 17 years younger. So he was really a younger contemporary of Meissonier, rather than being literally the next generation of painter. But he really regarded Meissonier as someone, as did many of the other younger artists, someone who had to be overcome, someone whose painting they didn't respect, and who really represented the opposite of what they wanted to achieve. The interesting thing about Manet is he wanted the sort of fame and acclaim that Meissonier had. He was deeply wounded by the hostile public reaction to his works and the critical lacerations. He really wanted to have the popularity and acclaim of Meissonier. What's interesting about Manet, though, is that he didn't want to paint like Meissonier in order to achieve that fame. As you say, he painted his subject matter and the way he painted were both completely opposite to how Meissonier did. Meissonier said that the only thing that a painter should concern himself with is the past. He said the true task of the painter is to show the public the past as it really was. And so what he specialized in, particularly in the 1850s and 1860s, were sort of scenes of cavaliers, musketeers. He was very nostalgic for pre-French Revolution France, the pre-1789 world of the aristocracy and the peasantry, and he represented this in his often very small paintings. They're often only about a foot wide, what he was known for was his incredibly precise brushwork. It was said by all the critics of the day that no one in the history of art had ever had such a delicate, beautiful touch with his brush. He was known as a finisher, someone who put a very high gloss on his paintings, effaced all of the traces of his brush, so that what you saw was a picture, an image, a vignette of past life, apparently unmediated by the mechanics of painting, by the brush, by the pigment. All of these things receded into the background, and you essentially looked through the frame of the painting onto this window into another world. Manet obviously painted something very different, both in style and substance. He decided that he would paint scenes of modern life, which was in the 1860s quite controversial. But he, I think, like a number of other progressive painters and critics, including the poet and critic Charles Baudelaire, believed that people should take scenes from modern life, and that it was anachronistic in an age of electricity and steam and great technological advancement in the middle of the 19th century, that painters were still rehearsing and rehashing scenes from ancient Greece and Rome, scenes from the Bible, mythology, and so forth. And so what they wanted to do was to step outside of their studios, step outside of the art galleries, and look afresh at the world that they were living in and put that onto canvas. And that's what Manet began doing in famous paintings like The Absinthe Drinker, which is this image of a man in a stovepipe hat sort of lurching drunkenly against a wall. It's an everyday and somewhat sinister image of modern-day Paris. His most famous representation of modern life was perhaps Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, the luncheon or picnic on the grass, which is this very bizarre scene of three figures sitting on the grass, apparently having a picnic. The two men who are in modern dress and a woman who's completely nude sitting on the grass with them, apparently having taken a dip in the river that is in the background. This was not only a very different type of subject matter than what Meissonier and many other painters at that time worked on. It was also done in a very different style. If Meissonier was a finisher and worked with this very high gloss, high sheen, beautiful brushwork, Manet broke all the rules of painting. He had an impeccable artistic education, but he didn't paint the way he was taught to, the way he was supposed to, and the way, for example, that the jurors, one of whom was frequently Ernest Meissonier, wanted people to paint. He shattered all of that, really shattered many centuries of artistic practice in works like Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe. And as I describe in the book, his painting technique, there are very things that he did that today seem very simple, such as using a white background for his painting rather than a dark one, in order to destroy the illusion of three-dimensional recession. He was really working against the whole perspective tradition of perspective in art, and working up into other concerns. He was representing figures differently than just trying to have them look as though their lips moved, which until that time was seen as the greatest task of an artist.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ross King. Again, his book, his brand new book, is The Judgment of Paris, and it's published by Walker and Company. We have a couple of callers. We'll get them in right here, starting with someone listening over in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. What about our period right now gives you an advantage to look at the big picture with the Impressionists that you couldn't have done, let's say, in 1940 or 45? Have the intervening abstractionists and, you know, everything else that lit loose, does that give you some kind of scope to, you know, sort of look down the barrel at this? You already mentioned a couple things I never... It was never told in art history class about these people, and it, you know, a lot of things just sort of set in place all of a sudden. Though I love the Empire. I go to Baltimore every once in a while, and up to Chicago, down in Cincinnati, and because not even knowing anything about art history, they affected me when I was a small child, and ever since then, you know, I haven't shaken it loose really, and I just sort of wondered how one gets out of his present day skin and to make remarks that you just made, you know, to cover that history. Thanks.
Well, that is one of the great questions that I pose in the book, and that in order to write the book, I had to rewind decades and, you know, over 100 years to a time when these images that we today maybe find somewhat, in many cases quite pretty, in some cases overly prettified, in the case of Renoir and Monet, perhaps, why they caused such shock in the 1860s and 1870s. I mean, the Impressionists as we were saying at the top of the show, are now a worldwide phenomenon with a tremendous global popularity. And so I think with the perspective of over a century, I was able to look back at why they were attacked so much in the 1860s and 1870s. The interesting thing about, I mean, you brought up abstract expressionism, and it's, I think, one of the reasons why the Impressionists, and maybe especially Manet, who wasn't technically an Impressionist, he never showed work with them, but certainly influenced them, why that their whole stream of art became so popular and so important in the 19th century, and why we regard Manet as the father of modern art, is because people like the abstract expressionists, who perhaps don't at first blush have a lot in common with Edouard Manet, all of them, their art ultimately goes back to Manet's studio on the right bank of Paris, because Manet really opened a kind of Pandora's box for art. So many things developed out of it. When it suddenly became possible in the third quarter of the 19th century to think about dissolving form into color, the way that, for example, Claude Monet was doing by the late 1860s, that a few decades later would really influence people like Henri Matisse and the Fauvists, and also Pablo Picasso and Cubism. Picasso was fascinated with Manet in particular, and with Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe. He made over 200 versions of it. He was trying to take it apart and put it back together and understand the magic and the mystery of it. And so I think we can see what became of Impressionist art from the vantage point of the early 21st century, and look back and see the tremendous influence it exerted over the course of the first half of the 20th century with all of these new artistic movements. And that obviously is one of the reasons why, as I describe in the book, Manet's star has waxed and Meissonier's has waned. I was talking about the sort of lip-moving realism that Manet had absolutely no truck with. Clearly, for much of the 20th century, art, modern art, was not concerned with creating these incredibly precise, realistic images. The sort of stock in trade of Meissonier, who was seen as the greatest exemplar, the greatest practitioner of it. Art took the route that Manet opened up in the 1860s rather than that was practiced by Meissonier. And so I think with that sort of benefit of hindsight, we can begin to appreciate both why the Impressionists caused such outrage, but also why they're now so popular and are so important in the history of art.
Let's talk with someone else in here in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. A bit of a digression. I don't know whether Focus 580 had Francis Stoner Saunders, British journalist who published The Cultural Cold War and the CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, but there's an untold story there about, well, now told but not widely circulated, about how abstract expressionism was subsidized after the war. It's a contrary to socialist realism. But I called up because in breaking down the Salon, there's an important story about Courbet. It's memorialized in the streets of Paris. I forget what around this month, but there's a restaurant called Le Palais de Courbet. Courbet, who didn't do pastels particularly, but was not favored by the Salon because he painted peasants for a land that is primarily a country of peasants, which France was for quite a while. He actually painted peasants. He painted everyday life. He sort of painted in the vernacular. One could draw an allusion to Angry Young Men and the breaking of the into the vernacular in the British theater some years ago. But I don't want to pile up too many allusions, but you know, it just seems to me that Courbet was important because he actually supposedly, I forget where I read all this, but he organized the counter salons and allowed quite a variety of art to be shown, not pushing his own particular, but basically reacting to the fact that, you know, the elite and the elite's wars and that sort of thing were what your antagonist wanted to chronicle.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct to bring out Courbet and his importance. And I do discuss him quite a lot in the book because he was absolutely crucial in the middle part of the 19th century. And, I mean, what he called his art realism, realism with a capital R, but it didn't look realistic to people like Ernest Meissonier, partly because of the fact, as you say, he was painting scenes of peasant life. And Courbet was a socialist and a revolutionary, ultimately became a member of the Commune. He was a great influence on a number of the Impressionists, particularly Claude Monet, who worshipped him and who even painted a portrait of Courbet into one of his paintings, his own version of A Luncheon on the Grass. Courbet was also a very good friend of the American James McNeill Whistler, a very good friend until he relieved Whistler of Joe Heffernan, who had hitherto been Whistler's mistress and the model for paintings such as The White Girl. Courbet and Manet had an interesting relationship. You talked about the counter-exhibitions that Courbet began forging and as he struck off on his own. He was one of the first painters to begin to turn his back on the Salon system. In 1855, he showed his work outside of the Universal Exposition that was held in Paris in 1855. He set up a sort of his own personal little art gallery and attracted the public in. He did so again in 1867 when Paris once again hosted a Universal Exhibition. And Manet was inspired by these examples, and he set up his own pavilion in 1867 and tried to entice the public to come and see work that wasn't going to be shown in the exposition proper. And so for all sorts of reasons, both in his painting style, but even perhaps more so in the example of his sort of personal courage in standing up to the Académie des Beaux-Arts, Courbet was a great mentor and inspirational leader for many of the younger artists. The interesting thing about his career is that by the late 1860s, he abandons many of the low peasant subjects he was painting and became a portrait painter of the rich and famous. And he would set himself up in Deauville or Trouville on the north coast of France, where the sort of aristocratic watering holes, and invite members of the aristocracy into his studio and paint pictures. And he became very wealthy doing so, but didn't necessarily see that this conflicted at all with his socialist principles. But you're absolutely right. Courbet is a vital character and a very amusing character in the history of French art. And so it was sort of a pleasure for me to weave him into the narrative simply because of his importance and his idiosyncrasies as well.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I have another caller I want to get on to. I want to thank the last and also take the opportunity to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in here. We're talking with Ross King. He is the author of a new book entitled The Judgment of Paris, The Revolutionary Decade That Gave the World Impressionism. The book is published by Walker & Company and looks very closely at the lives and careers of two painters, Ernest Meissonier and Edouard Manet. Meissonier was at one time, at the peak of his popularity, the world's wealthiest and most celebrated painter, and Manet, who helped to lay the grounds for the style of painting called Impressionism, was much the opposite. Certainly people did not admire his work. It was very controversial. He was not highly regarded. But the book takes a look at how it is that people change the way that they think about art, and to get us to the point now today where the French Impressionists are very, very popular, much admired by people all around the world, and few people, if any, remember who Ernest Meissonier was. Questions welcome again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Southern Illinois on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi, I'm looking forward to getting your book. Is it available like at Borders or?
It's available, as they say, at all good bookstores. It was published at sort of in the middle of January, so it's been available for a couple of months now. So yes, it should be hopefully available in copious quantities in the bookstores.
Okay, and can you spell Ernest Meissonier's last name?
Sure. It is Meissonier. And it's a name that you, as we've been saying, that you don't hear or see very often these days.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with him. Maybe 5-7 years ago, I was at a little rundown antique store, and I saw a pastel painting that I really liked. It was dirty and everything, and we bought it, and it had on the back of it Exhibition Universelle, 1855, and it said medal de bronze. I received a bronze medal.
Oh, right. Well, that's very interesting. I mean, that in 1855, it was Napoleon III's great attempt to show Paris to the rest of the world. This Paris he was transforming with wide new boulevards and so forth. And that pastel then would have gone on show in a giant purpose-built exhibition hall, what was known as the Palace of Industry, and it would have been judged good enough to win a bronze medal. Were you able to determine the name of the painter?
I'm not sure. It says Marquis de Posim, Deposim.
Possim?
Possim.
I'm afraid. Have you tried to look him up?
No, I haven't. I just, the frame and everything is really pretty. It's dirty, and I took it to someone to remat it, and they didn't know what they were doing, and he said, I don't know how to do this. The pastel is shaking loose, and so I took it away from him.
Right. I mean, pastels are obviously something that can deteriorate quite
the
quickly.
The color is really brilliant.
Yeah.
Still, it's a scene of a peasant life, like you were talking, a winter scene of a woman carrying lots of sticks on her back and a child picking up sticks in front of a little house of snow all over. And I just never knew where to take it to see if it was valuable.
I suppose one of the places would be an art dealer or an auction house, mm-hmm. where they'd be able to give you a valuation report. Posen really is the name of the painter, they'd be able to do some research into him or her and find out what sort of work the artist did and whether or not it might be valuable. The only problem with it, having won a bronze medal in 1855, is that doesn't necessarily mean it's anything that would today have a great deal of value. Because as I describe in the book, in a year like 1868, when you had exhibiting at the Salon, Claude Monet, Edward Manet, Alfred Sisley, Camille Pizarro, all Degas, all of the Impressionists or the proto-Impressionists.
The names we know.
They were showing that didn't win anything, of course. And then I give the names of the men who won all of the awards that year, and none of them, they're all in utter obscurity.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, if a bronze medal in the 1855 Universal Exhibition doesn't necessarily mean that it's a work that the 21st century is necessarily going to value.
I just like it myself.
Which is why you should buy art anyway.
Mm-hmm. I just find the conversation very interesting and looking forward to reading the book. And I'll let you go on with another caller then.
Thanks for the call. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It's fascinating to read the accounts of Meissonier and how he worked. He was famous for these remarkably detailed, heroic battle scenes from the Napoleonic Wars, and he was obsessive in wanting to get the details right.
That's true. I mean, he went to almost ludicrous extremes to make sure that he had everything absolutely correct in his paintings, whether he was painting his little musketeer scenes. It was said that he wouldn't paint so much as a shoe buckle without having the proper example of it in front of his eyes. And therefore, when he came to do Napoleonic battle scenes, he wouldn't paint that without having a Napoleonic battle in front of his eyes. And so that led him to stage, almost like an opera director, these enormous battles on with everyone dressed in Napoleonic costume in the grounds of his park at Poissy. And I think it's not a surprise when you know his personality to find out that he himself took the part of Napoleon. He said, "I have exactly his thighs." And I think whether or not he truly had Napoleon's thighs, and not sure how quite he knew how he knew what they were like. He probably did have world's first Napoleon complex with his delusions of grandeur and his incredible arrogance and pomposity. But friends would arrive at his house and find him dressed as Napoleon, sitting on a sawhorse, making drawings of himself wearing Napoleon's famous gray riding coat. And so he went to absolute extremes to try to make sure that he had everything correct in the painting. One of the things that I described, one of his obsessions was horses. He was said to be the greatest horse painter of all time, and he would sort of pose his horses. He had a whole stable full of them at Poissy. I mean, he would lame some of them, getting them to hold their poses, but he would also get the French cavalry to perform maneuvers for him at Saint-Germain, and he would gallop alongside, trying to understand in the days before stop-action photography what a horse's legs looked like as they moved. I mean, the holy grail for a horse painter throughout history was to understand the way, the disposition of a horse's legs and hooves as it galloped. I mean, generally, painters put a horse in a flying gallop with the front legs, four legs going out front, the rear legs going out back. But Meissonier had an inkling that that was not how a horse galloped. That's not the way its legs went. And so he expended tremendous energies trying to discover the secrets of equine locomotion. And as I describe in the book, after Edward Muybridge solved the problem through his multiple cameras in California in the 1880s, Meissonier was devastated because he realized that he himself had got it wrong. And he actually repainted the horse's legs in a number of his paintings in order to take on board what Muybridge had discovered.
Hmm. We have someone else to talk with here, a caller in Peoria. Let's go there, line number four. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
This is Norma, and I'm I recently was stationed in England. And
right.
When I went to Hyde Park one day, I think it was Hyde Park where they had the paintings all hung on the fence.
Oh, right, yes.
And it was such a joy to walk along, and I took the painting with me to Peoria, and it's hanging here. When I unpacked it, it has is a scene in the, it's Charles Lafarge, I think, is the painter, and it's of a woods where the stream of water is coming down from the rocks, and it has kind of turned brown.
The painting has turned brown.
It's in oil. And the water that's coming down, I said, well, it's the sign of the times. It's a sign that, you know, the water is contaminated or something. But anyway, I was wondering how to...
how to get it restored or...
Yes, yes.
Unfortunately, I'm not a restorer or a chemist or anything like that who I think you'd have to take advice from for something like that. I suspect what happened is the inferior pigments were used or too much linseed oil or something like that was used in the paint and it discolored. Did this happen quite rapidly after you got it back or was this over a number of years?
This is over a number of years.
Right.
It was put in a closet, and I thought it might come from the mat from behind where it's painted
right.
Brown.
Possibly that could have happened. Not to denigrate the people who set up their paintings on Holland Park Road on the north side of Hyde Park. I'm not sure that they are, I mean, some of the paintings are very beautiful, but I'm not sure they always use the highest quality pigments and so forth.
Oh, perhaps that's it. And then there's another one. In the Art Institute in Chicago, the painting is Parisian, where the woman is carrying an umbrella, or he's carrying an umbrella. It's a huge painting.
One of the Parisian street scene?
That's
near the Opera House?
Yes.
Or a boulevard in Paris, in any case?
Let's see. Paris on a rainy day.
Right, yes.
You know which one I'm
thinking. Gustave Caillebotte?
Yes.
I think the one you're thinking of, yes.
That's it. It is such a pleasant thing, painting, to sit in front of, and they have benches there where you can sit and enjoy the painting.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because Caillebotte has long been one of my favorite painters. He, I think about 10 years ago, there was an exhibition that was in London and probably came to America as well, called Caillebotte, the Unknown Impressionist.
Oh.
And he was younger than many of the other painters and died young. He died in the early 1890s. But he came from a very wealthy family and collected a lot of paintings. And he was very important for the movement in that he was one of the few people in the 1880s in France who was actually buying paintings by Monet. But he owned a couple of Manet paintings and Renoirs and so forth. And when he died in, I believe it was 1893, he left his paintings to the French state in what was known as the Caillebotte bequest. But quite apart from that, I think he was a very pleasing painter, and he's done scenes of floor scrapers, which I think are really wonderful. He was one of the few impressionists who was really interested in perspective, and some of the listeners might know this series of paintings where he is just workmen on the floor of a Paris apartment scraping off all of the varnish, and there's a just wonderful perspective in it. He also did a number of scenes of people standing on balconies of elegant Parisian apartments overlooking boulevards, so once again using perspective in the streets and along the boulevards and along the line of the railings. He's one of my favorites as well.
Is he? Oh, well, I just wanted you to know how pleasant it is to come into the Art Institute and look at that.
Right. Well, it's a fabulous place. I'm hoping I'm going to have some time this afternoon. I'm giving a talk there at noon. I'm hoping sometime after that I'm going to be able to go through a bit some of the rooms and enjoy the paintings.
Yeah. Well, again, I thank the caller. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of the program. I have another caller and would again want to introduce our guest, Ross King. He's author of the new book, The Judgment of Paris. He's also the author of the bestsellers Brunelleschi's Dome and Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling. He is now spending some time traveling around the country talking about The Judgment of Paris. And as he says, he's in Chicago and will be giving a talk today at the Art Institute, which is indeed a fine place to see some French Impressionist paintings and a few other things too as well. So if you've never been to the Art Institute, you certainly should, and if you can get to Chicago, you should take the opportunity and do it. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Back here for another caller, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I wonder if you could possibly take up the question of the Paris Commune, since the second caller correctly brought up Courbet, and what the effect was of the Paris Commune of 1871, which Karl Marx described as the first time the working class had ever taken state power in its own name, on the entire art scene of Paris. I know that's a big plate, but if you could have at it, and I suppose as a footnote, how does Mary Cassatt fit into all that? And thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's a very broad question and a very vexed question of the influence of the Paris Commune on painting. Many of the listeners may know what happened in 1871. In the summer of 1870, France was defeated by Prussia in the Franco-Prussian War. The Parisians were then besieged for 100 days by the Prussians, who encircled the city and began bombarding it. An armistice was signed at the end of January 1871, a couple of months later, in March of 1871, the Parisians themselves, it's still a question that's debated, how whether it was a working-class revolution or whether there were a lot of middle-class people involved in the commune. It's still debated by historians. Nevertheless, what happened was very significant. Paris essentially succeeded from the rest of France. It had its own government, and the federal government itself, of the Third Republic, led by a man named Adolphe Thiers, had to flee to Versailles and retreated there. 2 months later, in March of 1871, in what's now known as Bloody Week, the French army rolled into Paris and brutally suppressed the commune with as many as 25,000 deaths. It was absolutely horrific. Manet was deeply affected by it. He was in Paris during the siege, but not during the commune. He arrived back soon after, and the Seine was literally running red with blood. There were bodies everywhere. The smell of death and the knowledge that the French had turned on themselves and it was Frenchmen fighting Frenchmen. It really was a civil war. Manet was deeply affected by it and suffered a nervous breakdown in the summer of 1871. And I think it's a question whether the Impressionists turned their back on the commune. The art history is really split on the link between the commune and painting. On the one hand, there's an argument that these beautiful scenes of riverbanks and meadows, poppy fields, ignore the tragedy of what Victor Hugo called the terrible year of 1870-1871, or whether they're celebrations of a kind of essential Frenchness that has survived the horrors of that year. It's much easier, I think, to track Meissonier's view of what happened at that time. As I describe in the book, there was no ambiguity in his approach to the commune. He believed that the communards were devils, deserved what they got, and he was appalled at this kind of revolution. He was, after it, it sort of marked a turning point in his career. He became even more conservative, and really it was at that point, he was very involved in the banning of Gustave Courbet, who was a communard, from the 1872 Salon. When Meissonier did that, a lot of the younger artists were very appalled and turned their backs finally on the Salon altogether and held what was called the First Impressionist, or what we now know as the First Impressionist exhibition in April of 1874. So you could argue that indirectly the commune, through with its influence on Meissonier, led the Impressionists to turn away from the Salon altogether, just because Meissonier became, as I describe in the book, so intransigent at that point and so concerned with prosecuting anyone who had anything to do with the Paris Commune.
We're getting to the point here, we're almost out of time. I'd just like to take you to take a minute to talk about another Manet painting. This is one, I'm thinking again to back to what we talked about at the beginning, about the fact that here was a time when people were people could still be scandalized by a work of art. This is one that was a very controversial painting when it was first shown. It's a nude, and certainly in art at the time there would be no shortage of nudes, but something about this painting was beyond the pale for a lot of people. This is Olympia.
Absolutely. Olympia was probably the most controversial painting of the 19th century, if not of all time, in terms of the public and critical reaction to it. It caused an enormous scandal in Paris when it was unveiled in the Salon in May of 1865. As you say, there was nothing unusual about having a nude in the Salon. In fact, nothing could attract more admiring glances from the critics and more critical praise than a well-turned, especially female, nude. As I describe in the book, the Salon sort of pulled the curtain on a fantasy land of soft focus nudes with opulent contours and come hither eyes and so forth, and it was quite acceptable to have that image on the wall of the Salon as long as it wasn't too racy. What Manet did, however, was paint a woman named Victorine Miron, who was his model for the Le Déjeuner sur l'Air painting a couple of years earlier. He painted her in the pose of a very famous painting that he had seen in the Uffizi about 10 years earlier in Florence, The Venus of Urbino by Titian, one of the most famous of all female nudes in art history. The Venus of Urbino is a Venus, the goddess of love. Manet turned her, however, into what was quite clearly a prostitute. He put her in sort of a low-rent brothel. She's receiving a bouquet of flowers from an admirer who's probably on his way up the stairs as we look at the picture. And he also put, very provocatively, a black cat at the bottom of the daybed or banquette that she's reclining on. And the cat has sort of fiery eyes, an arched back, and a tail that stands suggestively erect. And this, all of this was simply too much, both the way in which it was painted and also, of course, this subject matter, where he was clearly painting someone from the sort of demimonde of Paris at the time. It was caused such offense that guards had to be stationed in front of it to prevent outraged bourgeoisie from attacking it with their walking sticks. And finally, as apparently they tried to do, and apparently then what happened is it was raised very high on the wall, sort of out of reach of the walking sticks, and also almost out of the field of vision of women who, it was said, were physically frightened of it and averted their eyes from it as they hurried through the room in which it was being exhibited. And so I think the wages of Manet's new style that I describe in the book were all of this, public mockery or fear, critical laceration. I mean, the painting was trashed by the critics, and also complete indifference by the collectors, who had absolutely no interest in buying any of Manet's work. Right. He didn't really sell anything in any significant way until he reached the age of 40.
We're going to have to stop. I'm past my time here. The book is The Judgment of Paris by our guest, Ross King. It's published by Walker & Company. It's a great story, much more that we haven't said. Thanks very much for talking with
us. My pleasure. Thank you.